it's not just give the IRS additional resources, the IRS is going to do more audits. It's actually that the IRS is going to be much smarter with respect to the way that it does its enforcement activities in ways that are going to decrease taxpayer burdens quite meaningfully.
Hi, I'm Jim Doyle, President of Business Forward, and you're listening to the Business Forward podcast. Business Forward helps local business leaders fix Washington by bringing Washington to them. Subscribe to our podcast to hear conversations with policy experts, elected officials, and business leaders about important issues like climate action and affordable healthcare.
In this episode, Business Forward hosted a discussion with Natasha Sarin, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the U.S. Department of Treasury, and Zach Butterworth, Director of Private Sector Engagement at the White House Office of Public Engagement. After opening remarks from Butterworth on the American Families Plan, Sarin discussed the IRS and tax provisions of the plan, including its efforts to revitalize IRS enforcement and technology, how to increase fairness in the tax system, and the steps business leaders can take to help advocate in their communities. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Hello, everyone. I'm Liz Fairchild, Executive Director of Business Forward. We are pleased today to host Natasha Sarin, the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the U.S. Department of Treasury, and Zach Butterworth, Director of Private Sector Engagement at the White House Office of Public Engagement. Zach, thank you for joining us today. I'll hand it over to you for remarks on the American Families Plan.
Thanks, Liz. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with such a diverse group that represents really a cross-section of the country and business owners and leaders across the nation. So I want to give a little bit of context to sort of the work we've done and sort of where the Families Plan is going to take us. So at the beginning of the administration, the president announced the American Rescue Plan, and that was in response to the pandemic. And we got that done, and we're coming up this month on 100 days since that plan passed Congress. And we're really proud of all the help that it's brought to people individually, to businesses through PPP and other programs like the Restaurants and the Shuttered Venues Act, and to state and local governments. And that money's flowing now, and we're really proud of that. After that, the president announced the American Jobs Plan. That's our infrastructure package, and we're proud of that. And you hear a lot about the president's negotiations on a day-to-day basis that he's doing with Republicans right now. And we hope to get a deal on that very soon with all of your support. So that's going to rebuild roads and bridges. That's going to make sure we have universal broadband across the country. That's going to harden our supply chains and prepare us for the economy of tomorrow. It's going to make sure we have workforce development investments. And so we urge you all to continue to weigh in favor of the infrastructure plan, because we know you know how important it is. And then on day 100 of the administration, the president unveiled the American Families Plan. And so that's what we're talking about today. You're going to learn more from Natasha about some of the tax provisions, but I want to talk about a little bit what's in the Families Plan. And so it's a once-in-a-generation investment in the foundations of middle-class prosperity. It's education, healthcare, and childcare. And so the American Families Plan is certainly going to meet the needs of today. It's going to make a couple of investments that I want to highlight. One is on paid leave. And for the small and medium-sized business owners on the call, paid leave is a critical component to making sure that you can, one, provide a benefit to your employees that maybe you weren't able to provide before, but two, able to compete across the country and even internationally with other large multinational corporations that are able to offer that type of benefit. So one, paid leave, and we're very proud that that component is in this plan. It's also going to make sure that families, especially women and fathers, they have the care that allows them to return to work after the birth of a child. The second is what it does is provides for high quality, free pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds. We also know that there's many people that don't re-enter the workforce because they don't have childcare. And so that's a very important component to getting folks back into the workforce. We also know that that investment in high quality pre-K has benefits for decades to come. For kids that have access to this, they go to college at a higher rate, they earn more money at a higher rate. And so we're gonna have just an overall better, stronger economy with those investments. And lastly, we're gonna lower health insurance costs by making the American Rescue Plan's health insurance premium reductions permanent. And so that's gonna help, especially these small business owners that are grappling with healthcare, to make sure that folks have access to healthcare at a reasonable price. And so with that, kind of give you a little bit of a sculpt about what's in the family's plan, I want to turn it over. I'm excited that you'll hear from Natasha Sarin about some of our tax proposals.
Thank you so much for that context, Zach. We really appreciate it. Natasha, thank you so much for joining us. I'll hand it over to you for your remarks.
Well, thank you all so much for having me today. I'm thrilled to be here to speak a bit to one of the largest pay-fors in the American Families Plan, which is our tax compliance agenda. Just to give you a bit of like sort of broad framing for why these set of proposals are so important, taxes that are legally owed but not collected cost the US government $600 billion this year alone, and are estimated to cost over $7 trillion over the course of the next decade if these set of issues are left unaddressed. That, for some context, is equal to all of the individual income taxes paid by the lowest earning 90% of taxpayers, or roughly 3% of GDP on an annualized basis. So this is a very large set of issues and a large set of problems that the president is committed to addressing. Noncompliance with sort of owed tax obligations isn't evenly distributed. While roughly 99% of taxes on wage income are paid to the IRS, compliance on the most opaque sources of income is estimated to be under 50%. So the tax gap disproportionately benefits sort of high earners who accrue most of their income from sources where misreporting is common. As such, the fairness and the progressivity of the tax code can be enhanced through more equal compliance rates that ensure those with the highest incomes pay what they owe. Our compliance agenda is going to raise substantial revenue. The career experts at the Office of Tax Analysis estimate that we're going to raise around $700 billion of additional revenue over the course of the next 10 years, which is backloaded so that it raises around $1.6 trillion over the course of the second decade. These sorts of investments that I'll speak to today also significantly increase the efficiency and fairness of the tax code. Today, evasion imposes significant distortions because of the socially wasteful resources that are expended to hide income from tax authorities. It also shifts activity into certain areas of the economy just because of the propensity of opportunities to evade. And it puts so many business owners at a disadvantage across the country, because they are fully compliant with their tax obligations, but end up forced to compete against those who feel comfortable skirting tax laws. I want to spend just a few minutes before we open up to questions by speaking with a little bit of specificity about what's actually in these proposals and reflecting on why there's such significant revenue potential from their implementation. The IRS has been depleted over the course of the last decade, and honestly, even before, but over the course of the last 10 years, its budget has declined by 20%. Its enforcement budget has decreased by around 15% in real terms, and that's led to a 20% decline in the IRS's workforce. These losses have been especially pronounced for complex revenue agents who are the ones who are capable of doing sort of examinations of global high net worth individuals or multi-tiered partnership structures that take significant amount of resources and significant amount of expertise to be able to do effectively. A statistic I find quite compelling is that today the IRS has fewer auditors than it has at any time since World War II. The IRS also has the oldest technological infrastructure in the US government. So its master file dates back to the 1960s. The result is that decades of tax administration have been built in siloed systems with a programming language called COBOL, which perhaps some of you are familiar with, but is no longer taught and thus incredibly expensive to maintain. The lack of any modernized technological infrastructure also means that the IRS just doesn't have the tools that it needs today to effectively meet the challenges of the day. So that's why the first piece of the compliance agenda is really focused on providing the IRS the resources that it needs to address sophisticated tax evasion. This involves providing the IRS nearly $80 billion of additional resources over the course of the next decade. As a result of these additional resources, the IRS is going to grow manageably over the course of the next 10 years by no more than 10% annually. but it will also have certain funding in place to undertake investments that have significant fixed costs. So things like hiring new revenue agents and training them, or modernizing a bunch of this antiquated technological infrastructure. The second kind of large prong of the proposal is the introduction of a comprehensive financial reporting regime. So when the IRS can verify taxpayer filings with third-party reports, compliance rates exceed 95%. Without any way to cross-check or verify the accuracy of tax filings, compliance rates fall below 50%. So the IRS and GAO and academic experts who have studied these sets of issues kind of all agree that increasing the information that the IRS has available to it is one of the best ways to improve tax compliance. The way that these new financial reports are structured is they build off of existing reports that taxpayers already receive from financial institutions and information that the IRS already receives from these institutions as well. Banks are going to report a bit of additional data on financial accounts on these existing information returns, specifically information about gross inflows and outflows on accounts. To ensure that the proposal is comprehensive, these new requirements are going to extend also to payment services providers and crypto asset exchanges. What's really important to stress for taxpayers, for small business owners, as they sort of reflect on these proposals and their efficacy and their design, is that there is no additional taxpayer burden that's associated with anything about this new reporting regime. There's no reconciliation requirement. For compliant taxpayers, the only effect of this regime is to provide easy access to summary information on financial accounts and to decrease the likelihood that compliant taxpayers are going to be subject to costly audits by the IRS, because the IRS will be able to better target its enforcement actions when it has more information about the potentially suspect nature of some of the tax maneuvers that are done by those who choose to evade. It's also important just to stress that in general, these compliance proposals are really focused on and designed to ameliorate existing inequities in our tax system by focusing on high-end evasion. Audit rates won't rise relative to recent years for those with less than $400,000 in actual income. That's a focus that's justified by the composition of the tax gap, which we know accrues disproportionately to those at the top of the distribution, who earn income in opaque ways where misreporting rates are high. It's also a focus that's justified by what we've seen over the course of the last decade as the IRS has been hampered by resource constraints. Its inabilities to sort of target the appropriately scrutinize enforcement activities on the top of the distribution have led to drop-offs in audits for those making $10 million or more annually that are more pronounced than the drop-off in audit rates that we've seen for those at the bottom of the distribution, solely because we've lost the ability, the workforce, and the resources to do some of this most complicated work. With that, I just wanted to thank you all again for giving me this opportunity to speak with you today, and I'm incredibly keen to hear all your questions and to get to engage on what I believe is a truly transformative and incredibly important set of proposals.
Thank you so much, Natasha. I don't think we could have asked for a better person who understands the specificity of the provisions in the proposal. So it's great to have you with us. And as I mentioned, we've received questions through the registration process from our network of business leaders. So as appropriate, I'm going to batch a few questions together, and that way we can hear from as many as possible. So first, I'd like to just discuss the details of compliance and enforcement. How will the tax compliance be scored for revenue purposes? That's coming from Linda Evans, director at IBM in Maryland.
So let me just sort of speak to both of the pieces of the proposal separately and how they've been scored by our career experts here at the Office of Tax Analysis. The budget side of the proposal has two components. So it has a dedicated stream of mandatory funding for the IRS over a 10-year horizon. That's about $72.5 billion over the course of a decade. And also a program integrity allocation increase that's targeted specifically at hiring enforcement agents or enforcement activities broadly. That's around $6.7 billion over the course of the decade. These together are estimated by career staff at the Office of Tax Analysis to generate around $320 billion in additional tax collection over the course of the next 10 years. So that's from an $80 billion investment in the IRS, that's around a $240 billion net increase. That estimate is based on return on investment figures that are provided by the IRS to the Office of Tax Analysis that are based on historical returns to enforcement activities. So in some sense, those estimates are conservative because ROIs just don't exist for non-enforcement kinds of activities, things like overhauling technological infrastructure or investing significantly in taxpayer service, which are also really important components of the compliance agenda. Further, these estimates don't take into account the deterrent effect associated with an increase in enforcement action. So the fact that if someone who's sort of thinking about evading their tax liabilities sees their neighbor get audited, that will increase the likelihood that they'll be voluntarily compliant themselves because they'll be discouraged from taking suspect tax positions. That's the piece of the proposal that's on the budget side. The piece of the proposal that's on the information reporting side is estimated by Treasury economists to raise an additional $460 billion over the course of the decade. That's largely through voluntary compliance because would-be tax evaders realize that, look, the IRS now has this lens into previously opaque income streams, and I'm going to make a decision to be more proactively voluntarily compliant with my true tax obligations. So it's important to emphasize that, and there are other, you know, proposals that have floated out around the world from academics in these spaces that have significantly larger revenue estimates associated with them. Like I said, in many ways, we think our $700 billion estimate over the course of the decade is a conservative one. It's a lot of money. It's $700 billion is quite significant. And in the second decade, because these investments are backloaded, that turns into $1.6 trillion. But its magnitude is really reflective of the magnitude of the problem of tax evasion that we're trying to address here, which is, again, this is closing just 10% of the tax gap over the course of the next decade. We hope to do much better than that, of course, through these investments and through other kinds of changes that you might make to the world of tax administration. But this is a place where there's significant revenue potential just because there's need for much more and much better kinds of compliance activities.
It's very helpful. And I think you answered a couple of the questions in this section already, which is great. So I'm just going to end with, will the enforcement provisions themselves be changed based on the proposals out there?
So I think the right way to understand, and this actually, I'm glad for this question because it gives me a little bit of an opportunity to speak to what has happened over the course of the last decade and the ways in which this proposal is going to address what we've seen. I emphasized just like very briefly that the IRS has lost 35% of its complex revenue agents over the course of the last 10 years, doing some of these really complicated high-end kinds of enforcement activities. So auditing someone who's a global high net worth individual or auditing a partnership, these take 300 plus hours of manpower from really sophisticated and really well-trained revenue agents who have expertise in these particular areas. So what you've seen over the course of the last decade as that expertise has kind of been gutted from the agency is just simply a lack of capacity to do as much enforcement as you want and as you need of some of these complicated structures. That's why one of the statistics that I find sort of most striking about in this world is that of the 4.2 million partnership returns that were filed in 2018, the IRS audited something like 140 of them. There is just a need and a resource need in order to be able to appropriately target enforcement activities that hasn't been met over the course of the last 10 years, and honestly, even before. And what this proposal is about and the ways in which enforcement activities are going to change is they're going to change by providing those resources and providing the IRS, not just resources, but the technological capacity to better detect and better understand when taxpayers are not being compliant. And what the result of that is going to be for broadly the taxpaying community, all of us and all of those who are joining us today, is a much more effective system of tax administration that decreases the burdens that they face each and every year, because they're going to be less likely to be selected for enforcement activities once the IRS has the capacity to understand the information that it's being presented and to better appreciate where exactly it needs to target its enforcement actions. And I think that that's sort of one of the hallmarks of this proposal is that it's not just give the IRS additional resources, the IRS is going to do more audits. It's actually that the IRS is going to be much smarter with respect to the way that it does its enforcement activities in ways that are going to decrease taxpayer burdens quite meaningfully. And I think I can't stress enough how important that is and how that's been truly lacking, certainly over the course of the last decade, as the IRS has sort of lost all of these resources, but even before that, in ways that we seek to try and address through this proposal.
Got it. Thank you so much. So I also would like to, moving into IRS modernization itself, focus on a couple of the questions we got submitted through that process. So you've answered a little bit about what does modernization mean for individuals. It sounds like there's a cutoff dollar amount that you all are focused on, but can you talk about the technologies that you're thinking about moving forward for the IRS?
Absolutely. So maybe I can speak to this on a couple of dimensions. So one piece that I want to emphasize, and I kind of spoke to it a little bit in my opening remarks, is if you look at a wage or salary worker whose compliance rate is 99%, why is it 99%? It's 99% for two reasons. One is that taxes are withheld, so there's actually, it's sort of automatic, your tax compliance. But another is that the IRS has a very clear lens into and very obvious capacity to say that here's information that your employer has provided me about what you earned this year. Here is your tax filing. I can compare those two things and understand whether or not a taxpayer is making a decision to understate or underpay their true liabilities. And that is true for wage income. It's true for pensions. It's true for unemployment insurance. It's true for significant income streams that sort of regular taxpayers are the ones who are bearing those in meaningful ways. When that cross-checking verification opportunity does not exist, the IRS just has no capacity, right, to turn around and say, look at a tax filing and say, are you accurately presenting your tax position absent an audit? So there's nothing to do, there's nothing to look to, there's nothing to compare to, absent actually trying to dig in very deeply to understand what exactly is happening. So certainly, and what's significantly in this proposal is providing the IRS some information on those opaque income streams. So things like partnership income, rental income, proprietorship income that don't have any lens presently in what anything about a taxpayer's position. What we are proposing here is saying, here is a way, without burdening taxpayers at all, we're going to be able to provide some information that the IRS can usefully deploy in its enforcement actions. What is really important and goes to your question about technology is just providing the IRS information. I mean, it'll perhaps increase voluntary compliance, maybe quite significantly, because evaders are worried that now the IRS has some capacity to delve into what's being presented to them. But without the technology to actually delve into what is being presented to them, that's a pretty fleeting increase in compliance, right? Because tax cheats, and many of them are very sophisticated tax cheats who are high-end evaders, will soon realize that there's no way that the IRS can actually usefully deploy the information that it has. And so why would I be worried about, I mean, I have to worry in some sense about randomly being selected for an audit, but in no meaningful way does my tax decision impact the kinds of the likelihood of enforcement action being levied against me. So that has to fundamentally change. And that's not just true for, let me just speak to it explicitly, that's not just true for the new information that the IRS is going to collect. It's true for the information that the IRS already has. So things like K-1 information reports on partnerships or the FATCA information that's already presented to the IRS, we just don't have the capacity or the technological tools right now to be able to absorb that information and then to be able to say that, let me compare two taxpayers and see, identify whether something looks suspect. let me compare a taxpayer relative to themselves in prior years and see whether a taxpayer looks suspect. And I think the right way to think about it is that the technology that the IRS has internally that undergirds our tax systems has to keep pace with the technology and the technological developments that exist in the world that sophisticated evaders are able to deploy. And what that means practically is it means that there needs to be much more aggressive investment in data analytics, machine learning kinds of technologies. The systems that the IRS currently has needs to speak to each other in ways that they don't presently. And all of that is going to take time and also substantial resources, which is why there is a $12 billion investment in technology plus another $4 billion being invested in ensuring that taxpayers have access to the credits and benefits they're entitled to. That's a part of this proposal, because we understand that without the technology, there's not going to be the kinds of developments we want to see with respect to compliance over the course of the next 10 years and also well beyond.
That makes sense. So I want to lift up a question from Karen G. in Virginia. She asked, will the IRS be hiring more people to help with the modernization, which you addressed already, but if you could walk us through what that hiring process looks like and just the numbers across time, I think that'd be very helpful.
Absolutely. And so I think that's a really important question, and it's an important question on several dimensions, because what we have provided for the IRS, sort of practically speaking, is $80 billion of additional resources that's going to roughly double the IRS's workforce over the course of the next 10 years. That is just sort of an overarching broad statement. But what that workforce composition is going to look like is really quite important to the success of this particular agenda. And it's important to the success of the particular agenda because what I've stressed sort of, and I gave you my statistic about partnerships, I can give you a similar statistic about global high net worth audits that, you know, where those audit rates have declined by about 70% over the course of the last 10 years. They take 330 hours, they take sophisticated agents. So how are you actually going to be able to bring people into the agency relatively quickly to be able to be deployed in ways that are really important on these dimensions? So it means being able to recruit talent sort of across the career spectrum, both bringing in agents who are early on in their careers and eager to spend their 10 years at the IRS, also bringing in people who have significant expertise already in areas like partnerships, multi-tiered partnerships, or global high net worth, or large corporate audits, which have declined by 50% over the course of the last 10 years. So it'll be important to be able to recruit across the kind of career stage distribution. And one of the most important investments, we've spent a lot of time with the IRS in designing this proposal, of course. One of the most important aspects that they stress to us repeatedly is before you even get to bringing some of that talented workforce in the door, you need to invest in the human resources staff that are going to be able to recruit and identify those people, and the training staff that's going to be able to make sure that they're kind of ready to be productive and active participants in many of these complicated work streams. And so the proposal is designed precisely, and it's another reason why the revenue is backloaded in this proposal. It's designed precisely to understand that the first thing that needs to happen is you have to identify the right people and you have to train them in meaningful ways. And the resources that are there in those first few years are precisely for those types of activities. And what you're going to see sort of from the enforcement perspective, and just not, and I should say, it's important to also emphasize that, like, this is not just a proposal that's about tax enforcement. It's also a proposal that's about overhauling taxpayer services. I mean, you all know the statistics, but the IRS in 2019 answered 30% of the phone calls that it received. During the course of COVID, it wasn't available to pick up the phones for several months because it just didn't have the resources or the capacity to do so. And that turns many would-be compliant taxpayers into non-compliant taxpayers because their questions can't easily be answered by IRS agents who are capable of being able to provide a lifeline and a source of support for different kinds of individuals on these dimensions. So there's significant investments in service as well that are a part of this proposal, and it'll be really important to give the IRS both the resources, but also the capacity to recruit some of this top talent. So in the course of technological investments, the IRS already has something called critical pay authority, which allows it to bring in expertise at relatively high pay levels for IT kinds of developments. We need to deploy that critical pay authority more in the space of IT, also expand it even beyond, and also invest in things like direct hiring authority to allow the IRS to be able to bring on a new workforce in a really quick and effective and efficient way.
Excellent, thank you. So next we received a question about simplicity from George Michael, a retired CEO in Golden, Colorado. He asked, when will filing 1040 tax returns be simplified to one page without having to use a tax preparer service?
So I think that is a really important set of issues and allows me to espouse a little bit on the nature of what underinvestment in the IRS means in a slightly different dimension than simply enforcement, right? What I'm struck by, and I'll give you a fact here and then speak a little bit about simplification in a moment. What I am struck by is that, and this is again about enforcement, but it translates, I think, usefully. You would think that as the world has shifted to electronic filing, which, you know, in the 90s, essentially no returns were filed electronically. Today, I think individual returns, like 93% of them are filed electronically. If you're talking about corporate returns, it's around 70%. You would think that that increase in electronic filing would have translated to an increase in compliance sort of organically, right? Because it's just easier to analyze data, let's say, that's coming at you through in a systematized way rather than looking at hand-collected returns in any way that is meaningful. And you haven't seen, it's a point that we make in our white paper, you haven't seen that kind of increase in compliance that corresponds to the data being available to the IRS in a more systematized way, all filed electronically. It just hasn't occurred. And why hasn't it occurred? It again has to do with the lack of investment in technological expertise to be able to analyze and understand those patterns and those filings. And I think the same thing is true with respect to sort of the kinds of simplification initiatives that many are enthusiastic about in meaningful ways. I deeply understand and appreciate the importance of having a more simplified and a more effective structure of tax administration that doesn't have so much confusion layered in for taxpayers who want to be fully compliant with their tax obligations, but simply have struggled to, given the labyrinth of our tax laws and the labyrinth of our compliance structures. And I think what's embedded in this proposal is an understanding that the first step towards getting some of that taxpayer simplification that is going to be significantly important to make the IRS kind of serve the country in the best way that it can is about resources. It is about investing in having these structures that have the capacity to best perform and best understand and best analyze and appreciate taxpayers' unique positions and advise them in ways through the IRS rather than through some sort of outside providers in ways that can be useful and valuable in this space. And I think one of the places in which we're making very significant progress in this proposal, and I like to kind of have the chance to lift up and highlight, is when you think about things like some of the extensions of credits that are embedded in the AFP that Zach spoke to up top, things like an expanded CTC or EITC, the ways in which the proposal has $4 billion that is exactly about making sure that it is clear to taxpayers that they are entitled to some of those benefits and credits, and making sure that they get access to them, and making sure that they're able to communicate with the agency in real, effective, meaningful ways. And I don't want to sort of understate the importance of the question and say that to George that we've like fully dealt with all of the ways in which tax filing can usefully be simplified in this country. That's definitely not the case. But I think the kinds of investments that we have here will enable us to rebuild trust in the IRS and be an important step in that direction.
Thank you. So we've also received a few questions about just security in general, given the sensitive nature of tax information. Could you speak to what the proposals do to help secure business individual information?
So one statistic that I was incredibly struck by as I was trying to understand the nature of this particular proposal and the aspects that are really important to think through is that the IRS is subject to 1.4 billion cyber attacks each year. And again, when you're dealing with siloed structures that are built in COBOL that do not speak to each other meaningfully, that were built at a time when the nature of security threats was just fundamentally distinct from the world in which you reside today, I understand why there are many concerns about the capacity of the IRS to best preserve and best appreciate and understand the importance of securing individuals' tax information in a meaningful way. And so embedded in this proposal are resources for the IRS to better secure the data that it receives, and also resources for the IRS to fight those sets of cyber attacks and these threats that are emerging from those who want to benefit from access to this really sensitive information. I'll say another piece about this that I think it's important to emphasize. The way that the financial reporting proposal is designed is very much with taxpayer privacy and security concerns front of mind. And how can you tell that that's the case? Well, if you compare the proposal to some others who have advocated for different kinds of compliance initiatives in a similar space, what you'll notice is that some of these other proposals suggest that one way to design a new information reporting regime would be for information to flow from financial institutions to the IRS. It already flows from financial institutions to the IRS, but also for information to flow from the IRS to financial institutions. So for the IRS to tell banks, that is the kind of taxpayer that we need more information about. That's the kind of taxpayer that's a global high net worth individual. That's the kind of taxpayer who earns a significant amount of business income. Those are the taxpayers that we'd like more information on. So can you provide it to us? And when we thought about designing this proposal, we were sort of struck by the importance of not having information flow from the IRS out to financial institutions in that particular way. Because obviously there's a worry that, you know, how are different actors going to use that information and what are they going to do with it? But there's also a worry that the IRS internally, especially with the additional resources that it has, is going to figure out how to best secure the information of taxpayers that is really important and really quite significant. But once you start letting information flow in other directions, you're concerned that the information is going to be leaked out into the world in ways that are going to be harmful to taxpayers. And so I think security and privacy issues are really quite important and ones that we spent a lot of time in thinking about as we thought through the contours of this particular proposal.
Thank you. So I want to make sure we have time for our final two questions. So I'll just bash them together for you, Natasha. One is on the general impact of the American Families Plan tax provisions. So we have two CEOs, one in Indiana, one in Georgia, and they're both asking how will this affect small businesses? What's the most important takeaway for us to think about as business owners from the IRS modernization proposals? The last one is from me, which is before we go, just want to make sure you get a chance to answer how can business leaders get involved with the proposals we discussed today, and if there's any closing remarks you have as well.
That is great. So thanks, Liz, for both of those. Let me first speak to the broad set of issues around kind of what we think that the takeaway should be for business owners from the particular contours of the compliance proposals and what we think is important to stress in this particular space. So what I think is important to understand, and I said it a little bit up top as I started this afternoon, but I want to have the chance to emphasize again, the way that the tax system is structured presently is essentially a tax on compliance and a tax on honesty. And what that means for small business owners, especially those who, all of the participants on this call who are so civically minded and engaged on these particular issues and interested in a tax system that is equitable and fair, what it means practically is that they are at a competitive disadvantage in today's business environment. And they're at a competitive disadvantage because other kinds of business owners or other kinds of individuals are, and you read stories about them every day. We know who they are, and we know the contours of the kinds of evasive games that are being played in these particular dimensions. So in general, the president's tax agenda is about bringing equity into the tax code. And that is particularly true with respect to this compliance initiative, because it is about ensuring that honest, compliant small business owners, who are the vast majority of small business owners, have access to a tax system and a system of tax administration that doesn't put them at a disadvantage vis-a-vis their competitors. And I think another sort of important set of takeaways of these proposals is that what we're, and in general, the president's tax agenda, what we're really talking about is expanding the tax base, right? So practically speaking, we're talking about collecting additional tax revenue that is already due to the US government that doesn't require any increase in rates, any increase in any other sorts of burdens on business owners that are part of this conversation today. And just from that alone, you will raise $700 billion and be able to fund very significant investments in American families and American workers. I think I am I work on tax policy here in the administration. I think all of our tax proposals are incredibly important in different ways, and I think they're all incredibly valuable. I want to stress how important the compliance initiatives really are, because I think without them, you create a tax system that isn't as efficient, effective, or equitable as it could be, and in fact imposes burdens on small business owners that are inequitable in ways that are deeply important. So I think that this equity frame is really front and center and front of mind for me for the administration as we've thought through the contours of these particular policies. I also sort of want to stress practically that a lot of times when you talk about things like information reporting requirements that have been proposed historically and have worked and haven't worked in different ways, you worry about, particularly for business owners, the idea that these already compliant, already fully honest, already fully paying their tax liabilities business owners are going to be burdened by undue paperwork and by unnecessary and costly audits in ways that are really troublesome. And this proposal was designed exactly to not do any of that, right? So there is no additional requirement for taxpayers in any way from this proposal. And also what we are going to do once we are better able, once we have better technology, once we have better sort of structures in place to target enforcement actions on those who are actually evading tax laws, what we are going to be able to do is reduce the likelihood that these taxpayers who are fully compliant are subject to costly and burdensome enforcement actions. So this is like the proposal is actually designed precisely to try and deal with and to try and ameliorate concerns that what we're going to be doing is burdening taxpayers in ways that are undesirable. That's exactly sort of, we are not. In fact, we're going to be helping taxpayers avoid any sort of burden and in fact, improving taxpayer services in really meaningful ways by making it much easier to communicate with the IRS. So all that is to say that I hope that this group, and it kind of gives me a chance to answer Liz's last question as well about how you can be involved and try to speak to the nature of the proposal. I think it is going to be hugely important for the small business community and all those who are on the line today to really be our partners in this effort and in making sure that this narrative about the importance of these initiatives is being able to be heard by your communities in powerful ways. I mean, I'm an academic by training, and I'm enjoying my government service in so many ways, and it's been a fantastic experience so far already. But what I understand and have grown to appreciate is that the ways in which all policies can become politicized in the nature of public discourse is really quite meaningful and important in shaping the efficacy of the agenda and also its likelihood of being able to be implemented in meaningful ways. And so all that is to say that I'm hopeful that we can work with you and keen to work with you and engage with you in any way that we can in order to make sure that the message permeates that what we're doing here is really creating a more efficient, equitable tax system that's going to help business owners, that's going to help taxpayers, that's going to increase the efficacy of the IRS. It's going to improve taxpayer service in meaningful ways, and fundamentally is going to lead to a more equitable tax system that rewards work in the same way that in the past it's rewarded wealth. And that's sort of a guiding principle of the president's tax agenda broadly, and certainly a design feature of the way in which we've thought through these compliance initiatives.
Thank you so much, Natasha. I think with that, we'll leave it there. That's all we have the time for today. So once again, thank you, Natasha, Zach, and everyone who joined today's briefing. And we look forward to working with you again soon.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. For more information on Business Forward programming, visit businessfwd.org. The Business Forward podcast is a production of Business Forward, hosted by me, Jim Doyle. Produced and engineered by Alexi Lippman and Alex Pastanen. Thanks for listening. See you next time.